You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
If I could have your attention, we'll get the discussion started. Thank you all for joining us. My name is Roger Cocchetti, and I'm the director of the group director for U.S. public policy of the Computing Technology Industry Association, CompTIA. On behalf of the Congressional Internet Caucus, I'd like to thank you all for joining us in this panel discussion. I think you all know that the subject of this panel is broadband reform, deregulation, re-regulation, no regulation, and we have an astonishing panel to discuss this from a wide range of perspectives. Let me quickly introduce everyone now so we won't have to do this as we go through the panel. Brian Atkins is with the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, a well-known organization for anyone who's dealt with regulation, telecommunications, and non-telecommunications regulation. One panelist who may be joining us a little later is Colin Crowell with Congressman Ed Markey. Cheryl Lianza with the National League of Cities will discuss her perspective from the view of the cities and the National League. Amy Levine with Congressman Rick Boucher has been involved in the issue as well as Congressman Boucher for quite some time. Michael Riley with Senator Sununu. Senator Sununu has staked out a position of leadership on this issue in the Senate and the Congress and has been outspoken, and Mike has done a lot of the work on that. Johanna Shelton with the House Commerce Committee this is one of her areas of responsibility and focus. Mike Sullivan with Senator Ensign. Senator Ensign, as many people know, has staked out a leadership position on this issue and on telecom reform. And is looked to by many in and outside the Congress for leadership on how to deal with issues such as broadband. And Howard Waltzman, who hasn't joined us yet and may also be late, is with the House Commerce Committee and is responsible for this issue with the House Commerce Committee. As you can see, this brings a quite a broad range of views on broadband to the panel, and one from which I'm sure we'll all profit. What I'm going to do is ask each of the panelists to share with us in about 3 minutes their views on broadband, the appropriate regulatory role for broadband, both their assessment of what should be done and perhaps a little bit of their comment on what they expect will be done. I'm also asking them if they care to distinguish between wireline and wireless broadband, since sometimes the regulatory debate on the two it can be different. For those who haven't followed the broadband issue, I thought I'd say a few background, give a little bit of background in the sense that broadband connectivity has been sort of the El Dorado for the information technology and telecommunications industries for decades now. It is widely believed and widely reported that the introduction of broadband will provide a wealth of new services, some of which, by the way, are public services, but a wealth of new services. And with these services will come entirely new industries, and with entirely new industries will come important new jobs, an increase in prosperity, and increase in standards of living. It might be interesting to note, though, that if you look back at the history of telecommunications, broadband in general, and broadband that carries two-way video is something that has been predicted for almost 75 years now. I mean, if you go back to as long ago as 1930s, the 1936 World Fair showed that by 1966 there would be broadband connectivity to every home and every office in the country. The only problem is that the 1966 World's Fair showed that by 1996 there would be broadband connectivity to every home and every office in the country. And by the time the Congress got around to rewriting the Telecom Act in 1996, the prediction was that by 2006 there would be broadband connectivity to every home and every office in the country. Clearly, there's a lot of opportunity with the advent of broadband, and we've seen some of that already. It's not that we don't have broadband deployment. We do. You can argue or debate the numbers, but it's clear that a sizable percentage of American homes and offices today are already equipped with broadband. The question is, what about the rest? And perhaps a larger question is, why is it with the universal recognition of the importance of broadband that the penetration in the United States lags behind that of other countries? And in some cases, the answer is obvious. When you have a country that consists of all apartment buildings, it's easier to lay cable than when you have a country that consists of outer suburbs. But even holding all factors equal, the penetration rates in the United States are not as high, and the service opportunities are often not as broad as they are in other countries. Final point I'd make in introducing the subject is to keep this discussion, this part of the discussion, in perspective. I spent a good part of my career doing strategic business planning for a network operator. And in doing that, you kind of quickly learn that there are six factors that guide your decision as to whether or not you're going to invest in a new service like broadband. And only one of them is regulation. Now, the regulatory environment can be a killer, but it is only one. If you have an ideal regulatory environment and the other five are not in line, then you simply won't invest. And we had a little bit of discussion about that earlier, but the technology has got to be there. I think most people would argue that broadband technology is there today. The costs, both the investment, the upfront cost, and the annual operating expenses have to be understood and be manageable. The elasticity of demand has got to be such that customers will purchase it at a price level that can be compensatory for the investments that have to be made. Competition, you have to understand what the competition is and how you square up against the competition. Regulation, and finally, taxation. Those are the factors we always took into account in deciding whether to invest in new services. And jargon and terms may differ, but I can't help but assume that that's the case for just about everyone today. But among those six, there's always everyone, I think, recognizes that there's a big three: cost, demand, and regulation. If you have an adverse regulatory environment, you'll shy away from investment. But you won't even get to that question if the cost and demand are not there. I think we all recognize the cost is understood and is within reach. Technology is available. Demand is there. The question is, what can we do with the regulatory environment to encourage greater broadband deployment and a greater variety of broadband services? So with that introduction, let me ask our panelists to tell us a little bit about what they think, and then we'll come back and ask the audience for questions. Ryan.
Thank you, Roger. I think that the challenge before kind of my colleagues to the left can be summed up in an experience I had last August. I was on a plane down to Raleigh, North Carolina, and I was sitting next to this salesperson from Cisco Systems, and struck up a conversation about kind of what we do. And I said, we state commissioners are sort of in the midst of an internal dialogue. What do you do about sort of voice over IP and broadband and kind of all the innovation that you are seeing in the market, and how do you react? How is the best way to react? And his response is, you can't touch it. You can't regulate it. A bit is a bit. You don't know where it's coming or where it's going. I said, that's fine. A lot of people feel that way. One of the issues we're trying to wrestle with is E911, and kind of what kind of public safety obligations the VoIP companies have. He's like, oh, yeah, you have to make them do that. And I said, well, it's funny because some folks feel like the commission and others are playing hardball with that industry. They might actually shut them down if they're not ready by a certain date. He's like, yep, got to do that. Got to play hardball. I said, all right. Another issue that we contend with, there's this tradition in the telephony world of non-discrimination. I would probably in the internet world as well. This tradition of non-discrimination. And he's like, yep, but you can't do that. You can't stop some applications. You can't. And I said, from getting where it needs to go. And I said, well, it's funny because I'd heard that your company sells these network analyzers that can kind of tell you what it is and whose it is and where it's going. He's like, yeah, well, sure, but nobody wants to do that. And I say that because it's sort of this microcosm for the process that folks up here have to contend with. I mean, in my case, it was sort of like a salesman on the way to a meeting. He didn't care. There was no stakes for him. Up here, it's bright, friendly, good people who are paid to put forth a particular point of view. And it's not easy to sort through all the challenges of broadband policy. I mean, his first two statements that you couldn't and you wouldn't and you can't tell, you know, all done by folks who are paid to kind of very much put that agenda forward. So that is kind of the challenge. And I guess at NARUC and among the state commissioners, we went through a similar soul searching and dialogue ourselves, kind of seeing kind of where the market is going and so forth. We put together our own legislative task force, realizing that folks to my left were interested in rewriting the act, and came up with a couple of conclusions. One is that if Congress were going to revisit the entire act and do a new approach, what folks do should be technology neutral. We found in our dialogue with stakeholders that if you go to the centers of innovation and talk to the brightest minds, Silicon Valley, Austin, Texas, wherever, places in Virginia, New Hampshire, Michigan, and Nevada as well, you find that these leaders, even they don't know what's going to happen in 5 years. And we thought, well, if even Bill Gates doesn't know where everything is going to lead or end, how we in government could handicap it and then write rules accordingly was just beyond us. So we thought that technology neutrality was a good goal in any kind of revamp. And then the other one, being state regulators and with the current thirst in Washington for preemption and national planning and big government approaches to things, we thought that we had to address the federalism issue. And so our conclusion there was, you know, there's all this, there are all these legal arguments. Is it interstate, intrastate? Can you isolate the intrastate component of this or that service? And you know, I found and we found that when you're talking to policymakers, it's nice because you can sort of cut through the Gordian knot. You don't have to figure all that out. All you have to ask yourself is, who is good at what, and why don't you just let them do it? And so to that end, you know, some particular areas that we focused on were consumer protection. State commissions in our traditional line of work handle hundreds of thousands of consumer complaints. The vast majority through informal processes resolved in a couple weeks without lots of process. You know, one-for-one resolution of complaints, something very valuable. I would argue that for the voice over IP services that are utilizing broadband as kind of the transmission medium for them, that's not a bad model to continue. I guess one thing I'll add on technology neutrality, I think that even as technologies evolve, what the consumer is getting isn't going to change all that much to them, and I think the expectations of good consumer protection are likely to continue. Interconnection, another issue we'd focused on. You know, all the voice over IP services out there that are revolutionizing the market, many of them aren't much if they don't call the traditional phones. That may change someday, but for now, it's very difficult to charge money for a voice over IP service if you can't call your grandmother and your friends who aren't on VoIP yet. And so interconnection to the traditional telephone system is something that is very important, and we can't, in sort of our excitement about kind of all the new products and the new ways, we'd be foolish if we sort of let slip by the importance of interconnection and a good process for mediating and arbitrating that interconnection when there's a dispute. Because without a referee, then the incumbent is the referee. And and without a fast referee, interconnection delayed is, for all intents and purposes, interconnection denied. So that was a big one we focused on. Public safety, the importance of providing effective E911, and I think that a vigorous enforcement role. And then lastly, universal service, I will say, was a big challenge that we focused on. And I think a little known and not much discussed fact is that with all the challenges to universal service, if you added up state and federal universal service together, states are actually shouldering about almost 20%, $1.3 billion, almost 20% of the national commitment to universal service. And I think as folks are considering what to do on the federal program, it is very important that you sort of have a choice. You can sort of federalize the whole thing and have an even bigger federal fund, or you can be very inequitable to the 26 states that have chosen to create their own state universal service funds, or you can continue that shared federal and state commitment to universal service. So those are sort of four of the issues that we have focused on in looking to sort of the broadband future and to how voice over IP and many of the applications that folks are looking to get over broadband, how to address those issues. So with that, I will turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you. Cheryl.
Hi, good afternoon. I hope everybody's been having a good afternoon and you're all staying awake this afternoon. I'm Cheryl Leganza. I'm with the National League of Cities. We are an organization that represents the local elected officials in 18,000 cities across the country. So your city council, your mayors, that's who my constituents, the folks that I represent are. With respect to broadband, there have been two issues that really have been central concern to cities. One has been this debate around franchising, which largely has to do with how are some companies going to deploy new infrastructure that would be offering higher speed technologies and video technology to the public. And the second is whether municipalities are going to be allowed to offer broadband services to the public. Elected officials come at these things centrally from an economic development perspective. What are they come at it from a public safety core management perspective. That's what your mayors and your city council are paid and elected to do. They're there to make sure that the locality is vibrant, a good economic marketplace, a good place to live, a place with good jobs. And they're there to make sure that the streets and sidewalks run and that people can get through town and that there's no holes in the road. And, you know, if you have a problem with something in your front yard, that there's somebody to call. I mean, that's really what drives the folks. And if you think about why you would elect a mayor or a council person, that's why you would do it. So in terms of broadband, I think we're going to get some good debate. I think it's kind of interesting how we wound up. We're here in alphabetical order, and it'll be interesting to see how the alphabet weighs out in terms of your views on these issues. I think I'll put in my few plugs, and then we'll hear what everybody else has to say. But I think one of the things that's, I think, often lost, and I was interested in Roger's comments about there's a wide range of questions, business questions, that drive deployment. And I think from our perspective, there's a little bit of a myth out there that broadband deployment is going to be completely governed by something like franchising policy. I think if you look at the business models or business plans of folks who are out there now planning to offer these great new services that everybody wants, these new video services using broadband technologies, those businesses are making those plans based on who the customers are going to be, how much money they're going to earn. That's the type of thing we want the marketplace to decide. And we've seen a lot of agreements come out lately in terms of those cities being able, those companies being able to offer those agreements based on their business model. And the regulatory structure is important, but these are sophisticated companies. They negotiate deals every day. And they negotiate with intellectual property folks. They negotiate with, they negotiate their building leases. So they're moving ahead in a lot of ways. And they always would like there to be a little bit less of a burden on them. But that doesn't mean that they're actually not making the decisions based on some logical criteria. The other big point I'd like to make is that these companies right now, folks are talking about getting into a new industry. They want to offer video services, and right now we've really gotten video services from only a couple of places. They have a wide range of choices of technology. We've got wireless coming down the pike. We've got maybe TV on your cell phone. Who knows what we're going to see? And some companies have chosen to use a business model that uses public infrastructure. It uses the streets and sidewalks. It puts infrastructure under the ground, and those wires are what's going to bring television to your house. But they didn't have to choose that infrastructure. So there are some commitments and there are some obligations that go along with using public infrastructure. And one of them is to make sure that the public safety is kept. And another one is to make sure that the citizenry is compensated when that public infrastructure is used. And the analogy I like to use that's familiar to a lot of folks who are probably in this room who do telecommunications policy is the federal auctioning of spectrum. The federal government has an asset it manages on behalf of the public. That's spectrum. We give it to broadcasters. We've decided we're going to auction it to cell phone companies, and we're about to auction off a ton more spectrum that we, under Congressman Barton's great leadership, that we're going to give some to public safety, but some we're going to give to the private sector, and they're going to pay for it. And cities have a similar kind of asset. It's the street and sidewalk. They spend a lot of time keeping that up. It's very important. Cities don't have any free source of money any more than the federal government does. And if somebody's going to come in and use that asset, if it's a commercial venture in a competitive marketplace, they need to compensate the public to do that. The last couple of points I'll make is just really about municipal broadband. One of the other things that cities are centrally concerned about is making sure that their communities are competitive, that their people can get jobs. And some communities look out there and they hear their small businesses can't get high-speed internet, they can't get it at an affordable price, and the city council is under huge pressure to do something about that because maybe the next town over has got really great connectivity. And one role, important role, is for cities to be able to offer those services directly to their citizens. And I think that this is one of these issues where everybody's going to have to play a role. The private sector, the public sector, the philanthropic sector, we are pretty far behind. And cities are just looking for the ability to make that decision for their community in a way that makes the most sense. So those are my broad points. And then the final thing I'll just close with is that cities and local government generally, we know this is a very high profile, very hot debate going on right now. And you know, I've outlined some things that I think are important, but we're also willing and have been willing and continue to be willing to talk about, are there some problems? Can we target those problems? Can we fix some problems with some of the processes that happen at the local level? We've always been there to be sitting down at the table to talk to folks about that, and we continue to be willing to do that. And generally, in that regard, you know, we've been following along. We have some general principles similar to what Brian was talking about. We certainly have been supportive of technology neutrality, like services alike. Local government has certain levels of expertise. Let's let local government use that expertise. You don't want to manage the street and sidewalk from Washington, but maybe there are other things that Washington does better or the states do better. And finally, just that cities need to be able to protect those interests of its citizens in terms of public safety. So that's where we're coming at from broadband, and I look forward to hearing from everybody else.
Thank you, girl. Amy?
Thank you. I'm Amy Levine with Congressman Boucher. I think this is really an appropriate panel to close what's been a great conference and a great day of sessions with, because we've had discussions throughout the day about different issues related to the internet. And really today, when people talk about the internet, I think they're assuming a broadband connection to the internet. And in order for that to be our baseline, we really need to be sure that broadband connections are ubiquitously available to people in this country, regardless of where they live. And Congressman Boucher represents a particularly rural district, and there are businesses there and people there that don't have access to broadband, which is a real impediment to their ability to participate in the global economy. And Cheryl talked about one way that we can try to facilitate broadband deployment, which is by allowing municipalities where they feel it's appropriate to roll out their own networks. And in fact, my boss is a beneficiary of that. In his district, he has fiber to the home that is provided by a municipal network. But another way to do this is also to update our universal service program and use universal service funding not only to provide traditional wireline service to people's homes, but to also provide broadband service to people's homes. And Congressman Boucher, along with Congressman Terry, have circulated a discussion draft of universal service reform legislation that not only would enable carriers to use universal service support to deploy broadband, but would in fact mandate that within 5 years, companies that are receiving universal service support be providing broadband to their customers at a minimum download rate of 1 megabit per second, with the FCC to review that speed periodically to update it as they might think that it's appropriate, and also with a waiver process so that companies that can't meet that 1 megabit per second speed, either because it would be a significant financial burden or because technically it's not feasible on a particular platform to provide broadband at that speed, could get a waiver. And Roger, you mentioned wireless versus wireline, and that's a way to that Congressman Boucher and Terry think we can encourage wireless broadband deployment. And we do have the waiver provisions that if the technology isn't quite up to that speed, there is an out. I agree with Brian that we need a technology-neutral approach to broadband deployment. Wireless in particular holds a lot of promise in rural areas of the country where the terrain may be particularly difficult or people may live a great distance apart. It's important for the provision of telemedicine services in rural areas where there aren't the hospitals may not have the facilities that hospitals and healthcare facilities in bigger cities have, and so doctors in rural areas can use telemedicine through broadband connections to send medical records back and forth, to talk and have video conferences and other types of consultations with doctors in other cities. So I feel confident that some people at the end of the table will talk about what the committees in the House and the Senate have been doing in terms of broadband regulation, deregulation. But one thing to keep in mind is that we do need to make sure that broadband is available to everyone and to kind of keep that in mind as we move ahead with legislation.
Thank you, Amy. Michael Riley.
Thanks, Roger. I appreciate the invite to speak. I'm not going to talk a bunch. I'd rather answer a bunch of questions. If your notes are like mine, it looks something like this, you know. Lots of different things, lots of different drawings. But I guess I would answer the question a couple different ways. What should be done? I'll start with the first point, and I know a lot of people don't like to take this conceptually. I don't know anyone that believes we should regulate the application side of this equation. If you're talking to cities, if I heard Cheryl right, it was about if they have a public infrastructure, and therefore, you know, there are a number of different things that play into that. Are you digging up the streets, and does the mayor have the right to protect public safety? But on the application side, I don't know anyone that suggests that we should be regulating that side of the equation. So I don't see a benefit on that equation. And a point that Roger made, in terms of is broadband available, I guess it's two different parts, right? Is it available, and what are the penetration rates? Why haven't consumers in those areas it is available decided to take up the advantage, right? We have still a 50%, give or take, that are still on dial-up, and there's a percentage that have none, even though they have an availability of broadband today. And the question is, what's that issue? Is it cost, or whatever the equation is? That's a viable discussion to have, rather than just kind of glossing over, because it then gets to the second question is, well, then what do you do with USF? I know Amy talked about expanding the size of USF to cover a new rollout of broadband in some areas and at certain set speeds in the statute, I guess. I'm a little leery on that concept in the sense that I didn't hear similar conversations on what we should do to reform the existing program. This is about adding new money to the pot or adding existing functionality to the pot or trying to figure out new purposes for the pot. But what about the pot itself? Is the pot broken? Shouldn't we be figuring out what to do with the pot in a more comprehensive manner? So when my boss talks about this issue, he wants to talk about the collection side and the distribution side, and not just about how we create a new path on distribution, but maybe we ought to look at the current distribution situation. One point that Brian raised was, and I think a lot of members in the Senate and in the House do believe a bit is a bit. And so the question is, should you treat different bits? Should a voice bit have an even on 911 capability, but a video bit and an internet bit don't be for some functionality because of historical reasons? And then Brian raised the point, I think if I heard him correctly, was on consumer protection. And the states do a pretty decent job, if I heard him correctly.
Sure.
Yeah. And the question is, how come they don't have similar functionality over the internet today? The internet, in many instances, works without. When a consumer has complained about the internet, they contact, some do contact the state and some contact the federal, some contact the company themselves. But the role of what the state, what the actual function or authority that a state has is much different on the internet side than it is on the telephone side. And so I'm not sure that, if there's this theory that we should extend the current consumer protections onto the internet side, I haven't seen the comparison or the justification for that. So I'm happy to flush that out, but it hasn't been made to yet. So if we have an internet where you have peering that works out on the company side, and you have consumers that are able to buy or not buy, and many consumers have bought on either the dial-up or on the broadband side, then what is the function of more layers of additional regulation, or I guess Brian called it a referee? So I'm interested in further comments as we go forward.
Thank you, Mike. Johanna.
Thank you, Roger. I'm still sitting here contemplating where my boss, Congressman John Dingell from Michigan, was 75 years ago when two-way video was coming out.
He probably
I know that in the 1966 World Fair, he was certainly still in Congress, so I'm sure he learned a lot at that World Fair
he
that
might
is
have been
bearing
the
on his. Obviously, I'll just briefly touch on the broadband principles that he and our committee are working on. Obviously, you know, the benefits of broadband are well known to this audience. You know, tremendous innovation, new and better services, lower prices for people, all kinds of consumers being able to do a lot of things that they want to do with their broadband network. Mr. Dingell has been very focused on encouraging deployment to as many people as possible and recognizing that these are sort of the networks and the connectivity of the future and making sure that the investments are put in and that the upgrades are made and that we really get encourage as much broadband as possible. So he's approached this sort of not wanting to carry over all the legacy, particularly economic regulation that you had in the phone networks, but recognizing that there are very important social obligations that have been talked about, public safety 911, law enforcement, universal service, you know, disability, various other sort of overall public interest and social benefits. That said, we are in a world where we have services that are functionally doing similar things, and we have been taking a good look at what kind of regulation those various companies have and trying to see if you can impose as much sort of the same regulation on things that are doing the same functions and same things, and that way reduce the arbitrage that has been somewhat rampant over the past few years. I do think that there is an absolute role for consumer protection. You do have a world where you're going to have the network and you're going to have all kinds of applications over the network, some of which are mimicking things which people are used to in other ways, some of which are not. And there is going to be, I mean, there's enormous confusion even among friends and family that I talk to over, you know, if their VoIP provider service has gone down, is that the network or is that the VoIP provider or where do they go? You know, what recourse do they have when they can't get an answer to what they do? And there's tremendous frustration there, which Mr. Dingell is very sensitive to. So the committee has been engaged in a lengthy process of looking at the telecom laws and working to try to put in place the right regulation going forward for these networks. We worked very cooperatively with the chairman, Chairman Barton, who addressed the group this morning. Last fall, we put out a staff draft in September, which tried to sort of lay out some of these principles, and which we recognized was the staff's best attempt at where things stood at that point. And wasn't perfect, but we sought comment from all affected stakeholders, and we received hundreds of pages of comment, in which we were reviewing. And in November, the chairman and his Republican colleagues went ahead and produced another staff draft and did a hearing on that. Following that, the members would be engaged on a bipartisan basis to move forward and work on the next version of what's known as the Biz Bill. So I was pleased to hear Chairman Barton this morning say that those member conversations are going to resume next week. It's been now since mid-December, so next week will be 2 months, and we're eager to have those talks resume and hope that they're productive and reflect the traditional bipartisan nature that these that telecom laws have always had.
Thank you, Joanna.
Mike, Sully.
Thank you. I think there's so many different issues that we could talk about today and touch on related to broadband, but I thought for sake of trying to confine this to 3 minutes, I'd briefly mention two big ones, two items that I believe can tremendously move the ball down the field in terms of broadband deployment and penetration in the United States, one in the wireless area and one in the wireline area. Let's start with wireless. Just about as we're speaking here now, the president is signing our budget reconciliation legislation, which we passed back in December and that the House just passed in the last week. This bill is going to free up analog television spectrum to make it available for the next generation of wireless broadband. And I believe, Senator Ensign firmly believes, that this is probably the most significant step in the wireless area that we could take. This is extremely valuable spectrum. It penetrates walls and buildings just for the same reason that your television set works in the basement with just rabbit ears. You're going to have the availability of higher speed broadband in more areas of the country, not to mention some of the unlicensed wireless uses such as WiMAX. So we're tremendously excited about that. And we think that's a significant step that's really going to move the ball down the field for consumers on broadband. We just have to hold the date. The legislation's passed. We've got February 2009 in our sights, and we need to be vigilant to ensure we stay on track, that consumers are well informed about the transition, to ensure that we're able to take advantage of that spectrum for consumers in the future. The second major legislative opportunity that we see is video franchise reform. And the Congress, of course, is considering these issues right now. By way of a little story, I'd like to try to contextualize the issue a little bit. Back on July 27th of this past year, 2005, Senator Ensign introduced a bill, the Broadband Investment and Consumer Choice Act. It was a somewhat glorious day after many, many months of work and deliberation in terms of how we wanted to draft this thing. We were finally done. We were dropping it early in the morning, and we figured, now we're going to be able to take a breather. We're about to come up on an August recess. And something that we totally did not expect occurred. That is, within about an hour of introducing the bill, the phones in our communications shop started ringing off the hook. Our press secretary was literally bombarded by calls, most of them coming from the financial news programs, Bloomberg and CNBC and shows like that. And the comments from these folks were, what did you do? What is this bill about? Why didn't we know about it? And can you come on the show, Senator Ensign? He, of course, had a full schedule that day, but picked one of the shows. He decided to go on CNBC and talk a little bit about what we had done. According to the commentators on CNBC, by the end of the day, the telecom sector, mostly driven by the equipment manufacturers, the market cap was up $22 billion. There was a tremendous interest. We got a ton of calls. A lot of people were talking about it. And the equipment manufacturers had a heck of a good day. And in reflection, we believe it's because that the federal framework that we laid out for regulating video, voice, and broadband services is the kind of framework that investors, that Wall Street, have a confidence level in that would allow companies to invest. We've seen companies demonstrate a tremendous interest in deploying video. I'm of course talking about mostly the telcos. They're seeing their traditional wireline telephone revenues being eroded. People are cutting the cord and just using their wireless phones. Folks like me use Vonage at home. Others are moving to cable telephony. The telcos need to respond, and the way they need to respond is to get into the video business and get into the video business quickly. This is a huge win-win for consumers. This is another competitive option for them. We've seen in areas where they have been able to deploy, such as Keller, Texas, that cable rates have come down. Consumers are benefiting from more choices and lower prices. And there is clearly regulatory obstacles for the swift deployment of these services. The companies are ready to invest. The equipment manufacturers are ready to sell the products. And I believe consumers are ready for lower rates and more options. And so we're really excited about the series of hearings that Chairman Stevens has laid out. I think we've begun a real good discussion in the committee. We're going to continue to work with Chairman Stevens and our other colleagues on the committee to continue to pursue as best we can a free market approach to getting these rules right, rationalizing these rules, as Johanna talked about, these functionally equivalent services that we're regulating very differently at the federal, state, and local levels. We believe we need to rationalize and modernize these rules, and we think consumers will benefit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to exercise my prerogative and ask the panelists to come in on the first question and say that given that we have in place today licensing and regulatory structures for cable television,
And given that we have in place today licensing and regulatory structures for local and long-distance telephone, if one were to operate a broadband network today that supported both multiple channels of video and local and long-distance telephone service, how would you suggest that network be classified? And would your classification of it differ if it were wireline versus wireless? And I'll ask any member of the panel who has a view on that to comment. How would you classify a network, or should it be television? Should it be cable TV franchise? Should it be long telephone license? Should it be both, neither, or none of the above? So anyone who'd be willing to go ahead, Mike.
Sure, I don't mind starting. We tried and tried and tried to figure out how, within the existing silos of regulation, information services, common carrier regulation, Title VI video services, how we could try to treat people fairly and deal with all these exciting new products, and we couldn't make it work. And that gave rise to the framework that we laid out, which was to treat video service providers, regardless of how you grew up as a company or what your background is, as video service providers. We believe that this should be about consumers. You as a consumer should have an expectation of certain core consumer protections, and that we can establish those core consumer protections for video service providers and for broadband providers and for voice telephony providers. So our approach would not be to try to fit these things into these silos that we really believe are broken and really don't make any sense, and that were designed for a different era when you had monopoly providers in some areas, new entrants in others. Instead, we'd like to try to get away from those silos of regulation and instead treat people fairly and let consumers pick the winners and losers.
Thank you. Anyone else want to comment on how you'd classify a network of that sort?
I think over this converged network, I think that if you sell securities, you should register with the SEC, and if you deliver telemedicine over it, you need to get licensed with the medical boards in your appropriate state. I mean, to some extent, you know, oh my gosh, how are we going to classify? We need to mash it all together is a little bit of a false choice. But be that as it may, if you're going through the exercise that folks like Sully and Johanna are doing, I think the good thing to do in each case is to sort of go back to first principles. You know, there are some things, if you're going to provide real-time interconnected voice service that interconnects to the PSTN, there are a number of expectations that you need to address, and if you're not, you don't. These are things that everyone has encountered, the E911 requirement, the interaction with universal service, and all these other things. So I think, I guess what I would just counsel is first principles on all the regulatory regimes that you encounter as you are attempting to wrestle with these questions.
I think I'll answer quite confidently that no matter how you classify it, Mr. Dingell would have Congress decide and not the SEC.
Okay. Anyone else want to comment on that question?
I just wanted to build a little bit on partially what Brian was saying. I mean, I think that to some degree, if you're offering certain types of services, then you do have certain types of obligations. In terms of video in this country, we've made a strong commitment to things like cable access channels so that the public has a voice and so that people can see their local government at home. You don't have to go down to City Hall to see your town council meeting. Believe me, my members know that if somebody's accosting them in the supermarket about what they've just done in City Council, it's because they were home watching it on cable, not because they came downtown. So these are important links that we have. And, you know, we have a whole infrastructure, we have a whole legal system in place, and there are a lot of stuff that's there for very good reasons, because these tough policy issues about how video should be treated have been sorted out over time. So I think that there's a real danger in just throwing everything out and then discovering later that some of these rules were there for, these laws were there for a very good reason. At the same time, local government, for example, we have some very strong capabilities in terms of managing the streets and sidewalks. If you are going to revamp the whole system, there are some things that maybe don't make as much sense in the sense that you now have, you know, the local government help managing the streets and sidewalks with some video providers, but they don't have as big a role in managing the streets and sidewalks for a telephone provider. Well, okay, maybe that makes sense that the folks who do street and sidewalks, that's all local. Maybe we would conceptualize that some, you know, consumer protection or something like that, that should be all done at the state. I mean, if you're going to go through and re-rationalize the system, if there are many who think that we do need to really start over, the League of Cities is not at the point where we think we need to start over, but if you're going to do that, let's put some logic into the system and recognize where the expertise lies in the different levels of government.
Can I, maybe I'll answer it this way. I agree with a lot with what Sully said, but Cheryl just raised one issue regarding PEG channels, and I wonder if we're not considering this in a backwards perspective, in the sense that, do you need PEG channels if you have podcasts, if you have video streaming? Can I not get my local city council presentation once a month in a video podcast? Why do I need to have a dedicated channel for whatever purpose because it looks like the cable model? And so I would raise the question that technology is eliminating a lot of old-time constructions. Do you need community access channels and a bunch of other requirements that are now laced with in Title VI?
Okay, let's open it up to questions. We have a few minutes for questions. I think the gentleman over here, if you'd stand up, it would be easier for others to hear you.
Sure. Okay. Drew Clark, National Journal, Congressman, TechPage. Let me just build on the point you just made, Cheryl, and also your statement earlier. You said that cities basically have a property right, if you will, in their rights of way, and clearly that makes logical sense. But I guess extending that argument would imply that the bells that already have rights of way don't need to pay anything else for the right to turn on video services. They already have broadband. They already have phone service in the neighborhood. Why isn't AT&T, SBC's argument right that it doesn't need to pay any franchise fees? Because all it's doing is using rights of way it has as an internet service provider and now offering video over them.
Well, the interesting part, and this is the part where this debate does get abstractly interesting, because as we all know, telecom policy has been made over time when different technologies were introduced. In some states, telephone companies do pay. They pay even more than the cable companies pay to use that right of way. In other states, because of the time period when that service was beginning to be offered, they pay nothing, and they've been in that right of way for a really long time, and they've never reimbursed the public for the right to be in the right of way. We also had some of those policies created at a time when nobody conceptualized, in the turn of the century when telephone was first being deployed around this country, nobody conceptualized we'd have a competitive market or that these companies would be making money in anything other than a completely price-regulated environment. So it didn't make as much sense to have a taxpayer and a citizen be charged in a way that they're already paying a regulated rate to the phone company, so it was all one government-operated, government-regulated system in which the compensation had gone back and forth. Now we have a competitive environment in which people have to pay for their business inputs. Nobody's asking Disney to hand over their content for free, and the streets and sidewalks, which are held in trust for citizens by local government, and in which citizens want services and they don't want their property taxes to go up, government has some assets, and they are obligated to well manage those assets to make sure that they manage the city budget appropriately.
Right, but that implies charging right away, not a franchise fee, not 5% revenues for turning on a video station.
Well, a right of way fee. I mean, a franchise fee is in large part a right of way fee, and the concept of rent is often connected to revenue. I mean, that's a really good way to distinguish how, what's the difference in value of getting Fifth Avenue in Manhattan and Main Street in Des Moines? Well, how do you decide what the rate is? It seems to me that using a market-based criterion like a gross revenue is a lot better than a lot of other measures that you could use.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes, right here. Please stand up.
I wanted to ask about, how policymakers achieve the necessary balance in policy. Let me explain what I mean by that. When Brian was talking initially, he talked about Cisco sales and he was talking. I know from my familiarity with people in the internet world, you work for Cisco, work for Google, work for Microsoft, and you start thinking about any of these issues, you think about things like scalability and interoperability, certain core principles of the internet, which are very foremost in your mind. If you work for a cable company, you tend to think about the channels that you bundle in with your offering. If you work for a telephone company, you think the government forces you to carry certain basic services to make money, I have to offer premium services. And all you ever think about is premium services and how you can dream up the premium services set. And I think in today's presentation, the telco who were there were reflecting that sort of view, layered upon broadband and internet. And I think the challenge for policymakers is to listen to people from these different sectors, to recognize that they have, as it were, in their DNA, a certain mindset, which they'll never change. They're just locked in, and they think about things in this narrow way, which can have its advantages. They can see certain issues very clearly. Other issues, they're just going to keep blind to. And what I've seen is at the state level, the PUCs are at a big disadvantage working with the telcos, because they're not powerful, well-funded voice to oppose them. At the local level, municipal governments are at a disadvantage with the cable companies, same reason. On the federal level, though, I think there's hope that there can be the necessary ones. And I guess, how do we achieve this? One of the hints that we had in the panel is that each of these sectors is often working with and deeply committed to an infrastructure which is totally obsolete and would only be supported if you owned it and had a big investment. If you think about how internet services are provided over the cable modems, for instance, it's a crazy arc of a hack, technically. DSL's a hack, also, if you're providing service costs. Should we go back and start from scratch and do it right over fiber or wireless, or for what? And how do we step back enough from the vested interests, which are raking in very large profits, which they can then use to fund their lobbying efforts? How do we step back enough from this to make it work?
Thank you. That's a pretty big question and a lot of statement there, so I'm not sure if panelists who would like to respond, please.
I think if you look at the bits bills in the House and take a step back and look at them, there is a real effort there to try to balance a lot of competing interests. And there's video franchising provisions which would federalize a lot of the video franchising process, and at the same time there's provisions that guarantee municipalities the right to provide broadband networks. There are network neutrality provisions that ensure that, as we're declaring a lot of these services to be interstate services, that network operators need to allow consumers to get to the content that they want to get to. Voice over IP is declared to be an interstate service, but at the same time, there are E911 requirements. So I think that there has been an effort to try to balance a lot of these competing interests to come up with something that does recognize that you've got, you know, new services coming to light in an area where we've had this silo-based regulation, and it's, you know, it's a really difficult thing to do. And you know, I think the staff, the committee, has done a really good job trying to work that out and strike the right balance, and are continuing to try to figure out what that right balance is.
Go ahead.
I guess the first half is sort of a political science question that you asked, and I guess I would take a little bit issue with the premise that, you know, at the state and the local level, we're just so overborne by these interests. But here in Washington, the balance is more even. I mean, welcome to Babylon. You know, there are, what, 29,000 registered lobbyists here. The truth really is just that it's hard everywhere. And I think the only answer is, I mean, frankly, you're sort of looking at the folks who, in addition to their bosses, are sort of paid to sort of sort through the competing claims. I mean, folks come in, they say, all I want is my network to be intelligent. What they mean is, I want the right to lobotomize the competitors on that network. You know, I don't want to make me smart, I want to make them, you know, dumb if I could possibly do that. And sort of weighing it all and sorting through is the task that's upon us. So I mean, to the political science question, I would say, you might even reverse the thing and say, you know, there's quite a bit of intelligence and experience and kind of creativity outside of Washington, D.C. that could be brought to bear on a lot of these questions.
Which is why I would put the question back on you. I mean, it really is incumbent on everybody in this room, if they have thoughts on where the networks are headed or what the architecture is or what's possible and what's not possible, to make those views known to us up here. I mean, because this is a difficult exercise for members to do, to try to synthesize just the lay of the land right now, let alone where it's going to be in a few years, as Roger was talking about. So it's really incumbent upon keeping us as well informed as possible.
Thank you.
I guess I'd go back to kind of there's a lot of different ways you could kind of come at this thing. You could try to, Johanna earlier mentioned that there are certainly arbitrage opportunities that exist today. In other words, because we regulate based on the historical kind of regulatory classification of different kind of companies, how you grew up versus what's the service you're providing to consumers, it's our belief that if you continue to try to kind of have government micromanage how competition in these different areas proceeds, you are going to have a difficult time. You are going to have to try to balance one interest over another and decide, well, you know, cable invested a lot of money, and so maybe, you know, they had some build-out requirements, so maybe we need to do something different for these guys. And the minute you try to get into the business of kind of micromanaging that competition, I think you immediately run into problems. And technology exacerbates them. The minute government thinks they've figured out a way to make everybody whole and tilt the level playing field just a little bit this way to make this work, technology will find a workaround. And as a result, we continually see new arbitrage opportunity distortions in the market. And so Senator Ensign believes one of the best things we can do to address the challenge of fast-moving technology, to address the challenge of different kinds of providers providing similar services to consumers, is to get out of the way to the extent we can and not be regulating based on silos, to let the market sort it out. Let consumers decide which video product they find the most compelling. Is it IPTV? Is it cable? Is it DirecTV? Is it EchoStar? Is it streaming video on a wireless device? And so in that way, I think we're going to try to kind of push the debate to as technology neutral a place as we can, and try to look for opportunities to not have to make those tough decisions about how you're going to tilt something in one person's favor of another, and instead step back and let the market sort that out and let consumers choose. And our legislation, the way we deal with it is we encourage private industry to go provide broadband, whether it's hotspots, whether it's a fiber ring, whatever it is a city might want, as a first option. Senator Ensign philosophically, fundamentally believes that private companies and entrepreneurs are always better providers of services than government bureaucrats. But in the absence of a willing an interested provider, we would say, from the private sector, we would say to cities, go ahead and build.
You might want to take this up offline after this session. We are actually out of time now. Before I conclude, there are two things I wanted to say. First, I think as all of you know, this is the concluding session for today's State of the Net conference, and on behalf of the Congressional Internet Caucus, I'd like to thank all of you for joining us for this this day's program. It was one of the best of the series, and look forward to all of you coming back for the State of the Net conference next year. Also, a quick announcement for those who have forgotten or didn't know, the reception begins at 5 o'clock. It's in the Senate Dirksen Building, which is the middle of the three Senate office buildings, and it's in room G50. So if you haven't made plans, please do plan to come by there. It's about a 15-minute walk from here. I think you'll have a good time. Please join me in thanking the panel for a great presentation, very insightful discussion.